Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Dave Schrader. That's Tim Dennis. For those of you that are new to the show, maybe just finding us through Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, welcome. Welcome to the program. Thank you very much for joining us. Please do us a favor, rate and review the programs. That really helps to make our public presence stretch even further than it already is. It is a pleasure to have finally made the leap and be a part of the Stitcher Premium podcast family and make our shows available here. It is great to have you join us. So thank you all for being a part of our world. Now, on these programs, if you're new to the show, just to give you a little understanding, we usually will speak with a fantastic guest, talk to them about the book, the program, whatever it is that they're promoting. But then a little later on, we do something called Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, in which we will talk about some of the weirdest crimes that have taken place over the last week or news stories that have been sent in to us. If you have dumb stories from your neck of the woods and you'd like to share them with us on the air, you can email them to me, Dave@darknessradio.com. That's Dave@darknessradio.com. So if you found True Crime Tuesday, we are a program that talks primarily about true crime on these days. The other two shows we do per week are slanted towards the paranormal. Darkness Radio, the best in paranormal talk radio. You can also find that through Stitcher Premium and Stitcher Resources. So please check out Darkness Radio or True Crime Tuesday. Let's get started with the show, Tim. I'm excited. The change is here.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, we're here. New form, new platform, and giving you a great opportunity to join in at a wonderful point. We cover all different types of strange crimes, serial killers, old unsolved mysteries, and some of my favorite stories have to do with mafia and mob-like stories, Tim. And our guest today is going to introduce us to something I was unfamiliar with. The Dixie Mafia.
Yeah.
The Dixie Mafia.
I can't say I'm familiar.
Yeah. I am not either. So when I heard about this, I was like, yeah, this is definitely something we need to dip into. The book is called Silenced by the Dixie Mafia, The Anderson Files, Legends of the Deep South. The author, Sonova Cantrell, is here with us. Sonova, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Another fantastic book out and available. So we've got a link for that on today's program. We've got links for Sonova to follow on her social media as well. Sonova, talk to us a little bit about this. I mean, you know, I have family from the Deep South. I had no clue there was a Dixie Mafia. What drew your attention to write something like this?
Well, I run a cold case blog on Sonova Inc. And I work with victims' family members. And so I try to find the obscure cases that have gone unsolved for decades. And these families are desperate to get their story out. Now, I've built my platform up to where my potential viewership is 500,000. So I try to take my marketing skills and throw these cases out in front of as many eyes as possible. Well, in that process, I met a lady named Phyllis Anderson. And this book actually got me started on the Dixie Mafia because her family was killed by members of the Dixie Mafia. Now, what people think of when you say mafia, they think of the Italians. And in reality, mafia is just a group of organized criminals. And then, you know, we put different tags to them. Well, there is a group of organized criminals in the South, and they were known as the Dixie Mafia. I have an intelligence report that I always bring out when I do my interviews on this, because it is something that if you've heard about it, a lot of people want to say that it doesn't exist. It's just, you know, something that the media made up. But in 1974, I have a copy of an intelligence report titled The Dixie Mafia. It was prepared by the Office of the Attorney General, Vern Miller, for the state of Kansas. And this 1974 report is 140-some-odd pages of incidents to do with this group they call the Dixie Mafia. And they are intertwined with the Italians in different facets. They worked alongside the Italians. Sometimes the Italian, or the Italians, however you want to pronounce it, the Italian mafia, they had a specific set of rules. And so if they wanted something done, but it may not have gone their rules, sometimes the Dixies would be hired out. So there was times where sometimes the Dixies did the dirty work for the Italians, and there's different links to them that way. But they are completely organized, completely different than the Italian Mafia. For those of you that haven't followed the Italian Mafia, it's set up like a major corporation, and the Dixies are not. It is very loosely, this loosely knit group. They literally have areas and factions that certain people, certain bosses control, maybe a county or this, northeast side of a state or something like that. And then they had specialized criminals in each area. So if you were going to go rob a bank, you would want to get, a specialist in surveillance. You'd want to get a specialist, in someone that could bust open the safe, someone who is a specialist, getaway driver. And so these criminals were almost like a network of freelance criminals that if you were in an area and you needed a job done, so-and-so worked this area. And then everybody in that county usually paid off the boss. So if you came through a certain county and there was a boss in that county, you'd have to get his permission before you did something, or you would get in trouble. As long as you paid them a good cut, a lot of times they'd let you do whatever you were going to do. So it is a legitimate thing. I have a quote that
Really quickly, Sonova. So again, as you said, when we think of the word mafia, we often think of the Italians. We think maybe even of the Jewish mafia and the integration, the Irish mafia. Right. You've got kind of these different ethnic versions that are really the ones that are considered. Now, with this, you've got the Dixie Mafia. Are they one specific mixture of ethnicity or race primarily, or is it kind of just a mishmash of whatever, just whoever's brought into that little realm of criminality?
Now, we're talking back in the 70s and 80s, and even a little bit in the 60s, but they really were more prevalent in the 70s and 80s. And to be honest with you, they were all a bunch of white Southerners. And the only time they would allow an African-American in is if he could make them enough money. So there was a lot of connections, and I'm not saying everybody was connected, but there was a lot of connections between some of the Dixie Mafia people and the Ku Klux Klan. So it was very rare for someone in the Dixie Mafia to let any other ethnicity in, unless you could make them a lot of money. Then they would back off of it a little bit, but they were pretty racial.
But they were never really, you would never be allowed as a higher up. You might be a captain or something underneath the team bosses and the godfathers, if you will.
Right. And that's something else with the Dixie Mafia. They didn't have a hierarchy of bosses and underbosses and things like the Italians did. What they did was they were extremely, extremely vicious. And there's different, I'm digging, if you hear the rustling of papers, I apologize. I'm digging for my other quote that I misplaced. They were literally more vicious than their Italian counterparts because they did not have any rules. And so when you, when you were in the Italian mob, everything circled around the family. And the whole concept of the Italian Mafia was to make money for the family. It wasn't about the individual participants in the mafia. And so, but you take that and flip it on its head, and that's the way the Dixies operated. They were all in it for themselves. And so, if you were Italian, you wasn't supposed to mess around with a made man's wife. You weren't supposed to kill a public figure. You wasn't, all these things because you didn't want to bring heat on from law enforcement. Well, the Dixies didn't have that problem. They went around and bought off all of the law enforcement that they could. So what would happen is these little, they really set up, they were very strategic they would set up in the poorest little neighborhoods they could find, because they knew that the county sheriff and the police, for one, there wasn't very many, you know, officers to cover this vast county. But two, they knew that that officer wasn't making enough to hardly put food on his kids, you know, for his kids' plates. And so it was easy for them to manipulate and say, well, we're not asking you to do a crime, but if we do something, we just want you to look away and we'll pay you a year's worth of wages every month, you know?
Wow.
And so, you know, 'cause you're talking down there during that time span, a lot of these county, like law enforcement, they were only making at the most $1,500 a year. So you're talking like,
wait,
early
law enforcement, 70s. Law enforcement was making $1,500 a year?
Yes.
That can't be,
right? When you go down to Mississippi, in some of these poorer parts in Mississippi, and we're talking late 60s, early 70s, they would make about $1,500 to $2,000 a year in Mississippi. And this is where the core group started. And so you're talking at this time, in 1964, during some of the big Mississippi burning cases and things, most of the people were literally making a third of what the national average was for the lowest class. And so they were extremely poor. And so this is the kind of people and neighborhoods that they would target, because they knew these people were just barely surviving and they could pay them off. And so this is where they went. This is where they operated. And so they would go through and pay these people a year's wages. And of course they would turn their heads, you know, unless it got to where it was bringing a lot of heat from outside, they would let them, you know, have free reign because they needed the money. You know, they were desperate. So, but this is kind of the way they set up. I have the other quote. I found it. Now, this is a quote from the Chief Deputy Wallace Laird, Covington, Louisiana Sheriff's Department. Okay, this is 1971. It was given to the Orlando Sentinel. It says, "I would rather take my chances with the original mafia. They're not as trigger happy as their Dixie counterparts." And this is a sheriff's deputy from Louisiana in 1971. This is how vicious they were. And now if you go to 1974 and you reference this intelligence report that I have, there's another quote by Agent James Duff of the Georgia State Organized Crime Intelligence Unit. This is 1974. It says, "There is no other group anywhere in the country as mobile and as well organized as the Dixie Mafia." So,
do you know,
you've got
did the Italian Mafia ever try to either muscle their way in,
mm-hmm,
or work hand in hand with this Dixie Mafia? Or was the Dixie Mafia so vicious and so unregulated that the regular mob just left them alone because it was like, hey, there's no rules here. These guys are nuts.
They are. And you could, I actually got asked to be a part of the National Crime Syndicate. It's a group of elite true crime writers. And so I'm part of the admin there. And one of the guys that's an admin, he is the grandson of Boss Toco out of Detroit. Well, when I said something about the Dixie Mafia, his grandson, Gunner, actually knew what I was talking about. He's like, oh yeah, I've heard those Dixies are crazy. You know, and so we're talking all these generations later, an ex-mob enforcer knows who the Dixies were, you know, and it's because they were so violent. If you do your research in true crime and you see about the Gypsy Camp murders, and I don't have the paperwork in front of me, so I can't give you the exact date, but it was right around the same time. They literally broke into a Gypsy Camp in New Orleans during Mardi Gras, because all of the men were gone and there was just a few straggling elderly people and some children left in the camp. There was rumored to have a safe in this little trailer house camp or whatever it was. And it's supposed to have several hundred thousand dollars. Well, that wasn't true. But this group of Dixies came in and they ransacked the place. They took the gypsy queen or whatever you call her, and they beat her senseless, trying to get her to tell them where this was. And she kept telling them, we don't have a safe. And one of these gentlemen, which it never says, I have a good idea which one of them it was, but out of this group of masked gunmen, one of them lost his temper and literally chopped her down the skull with an axe. He was just mad, and I have a feeling I know which one it was because he was a psychopathic killer and he's a known Dixie Mafia serial killer, and he was part of that group that day. So I have a feeling I know which one it was, but I don't have any proof of it. So I hesitate to say his name because he does have, you know, grandchildren and stuff available, you know, that's here. But there are some major names in there. And
Can I ask you really quickly? Yeah. So when you have kind of renegade factions like this,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did they clash within their own culture? Were there broken down factions of the Dixie Mafia, and would there be warring between them? What was that like?
Yes. Well, see, that's the thing. They didn't have like capos and godfathers and things. It literally, you got your ranking based on how long you could survive. So Kirksey Nix Jr. is actually still in prison, and he's known as a Dixie Mafia kingpin. Well, the reason being is he's outlived everyone else. And his father was a judge in Oklahoma, and so he had a lot of free reign. But there's a core group, and then they worked with a bunch of, you might call them freelance criminals, all across the South, from Texas to Georgia and back. I mean, everywhere through the South, you can see their footprints from their crimes. You can just, you know, you can almost map it out. If you study, of course, decades later, you can see it all laid out. But basically, if they wanted something that you had better have enough firepower and enough grit to keep it, or it was going to be gone and you would be dead. If they wanted your woman, they would take her. If they wanted your, you know, so you come in and I use this as an analogy. It's kind of a poor analogy, but people kind of know what I'm talking about when I mention this. If anybody watched that old show, Dukes of Hazzard, you've got they're kind of painted as bumbling idiots, but you've got Boss Hogg and then Roscoe, the sheriff. Well, they're kind of painted as a couple of idiots that don't actually accomplish anything. But in reality, that's kind of the structure. It kind of gives you a glimpse of the structure of the Dixie Mafia. Boss, he had control over all of the crime in that county. And then he had the sheriff in his pocket. And then anybody wanted to come in, he had to defend his county if somebody bigger came in. If he had the firepower and the grit and the whatever to maintain that, then he would remain as the boss. Otherwise, he would get plowed over by the next guy. And so this is the reason why I think you don't see the structure, the organization in the Dixie Mafia that you see in the Italians, because the Italians actually, they were very vicious at the beginning until they were organized into the commission by Lucky Luciano and those guys. And so basically you take the rogue factions of the Italians before they were organized, add a little bit of viciousness, and you've got the Dixies, and they just remained in that phase.
Did they use, because it was the South, would they use the African American culture as their soldiers, even though they didn't have official titles? Would that be who they would send out against each other, or employ gangs that would go do their dirty work for them in these warring moments?
No, it usually was all out war between each person. And so
it was more Hatfield and McCoys then.
Right. Okay. Exactly. I mean, it was all out chaos and war. And unfortunately, there was a lot of innocent blood shed in between there, you know, because this person hates that person. They come into town, it's all out war. And so you have a lot of innocent people that got caught in a crossfire. And so it was very vicious and very bloody. And it, you know, just down to like the thing that happened to, was the gypsy lady. That was just because they heard a rumor that there might be money in that camp, you know? And, so it, that was the kind of brutality that people dealt with. And so you literally, if a Dixies came up and wanted what you had, most people just gave it to them because they knew that it wasn't worth the fight. And so, you know, they had a lot of people. They had some, I talked to an investigator, a retired investigator, that one of Kirksey Nicks actually had a hit out on him at one point in time. But Kirksey Nicks and some of his crew were actually running some way back when, you know, credit cards were brand new and all this. They were trying to run some scams with those in Dallas. So that connects them all the way to Dallas, you know. And so they literally span the southern United States. Now, I will tell you one thing that really surprised me in my investigations, in my study. We all know that the Italian mafia was kind of disbanded and interrupted by the use of the RICO Act. And so they, you know, Giuliani used the RICO Act to really tear down the mafia to where it's not what it used to be. Well, I always thought that that was the first time that that was used successfully. Well, in my research, I discovered a newspaper article where the first RICO indictment in the U.S. was actually against a Dixie Mafia kingpin out of Georgia.
And really? So
they actually used that successfully from a guy in Georgia 3 years before they went after the Italians with it.
Oh, sure. So once they were able to actually get over with the RICO predicate somewhere else, I'm sure that's what made it easier for Giuliani to start to use in right. breaking down the law. Because once it's kind of in place in the country, it becomes right. Easier to instill other places, correct?
Right, right. And see, the Dixie Mafia kingpin in Georgia, his drug operation, it was big enough. But it was nothing in comparison to the Italian mafia, you know, size and structure-wise. But they were successful by taking this guy down with it. So it was like almost like a practice run. You know, they're like, okay, we got this guy and his. So now let's hit the Italians in New York. You know, it was almost like a practice gotcha. Run 3 years before New York.
Gotcha. Very weird. Now, mm-hmm. you know, when you think of the mafia, obviously, you know, you've got your Capones and your, you know, Lucky Luciano, Bugsy Siegel. You've got some of these famous names that kind of appear, the Gotti family and so right. on. Is there that same kind of reverence for the mafia in the South? Are there famous mobsters, if you will, and famous names down there we might not be familiar with?
Yes, there is. I just think that it's because Hollywood hasn't glamorized the Dixies is the reason why you haven't heard of them like you would. Because everyone, whether you watch mob movies or not, has heard of The Godfather. You know, everyone, you know, has these little slang terms that have become part of our everyday vernacular. And it's because of these different mob movies, you know, but they don't do that with the Dixies. Now, one of the main ones that kind of, he didn't really start the Dixie Mafia, but he was at the beginning, was his name's Carl Douglas White, but they called him Toehead White. Now, he was one of them that there's a lot of Dixie Mafia, so you might say, but not all of them carry themselves like a mobster. So Toehead White, actually in 1955, he was actually a driver for Carlos Marcello, which of course is an Italian mobster. And he was a driver. So it was almost like as a teenager, he got the taste of Italian mafia. And then when he became of age, he actually carried himself like an Italian mobster. He was the one that wore the expensive suits and the crocodile shoes, and the, you know, he was almost out of place down south where he was, because, and he didn't care, you know, he carried himself like a mobster. But then there's others that they blended in. They didn't try to, you know, wear the expensive clothes and drive the craziest expensive car. They more blended in. And so there's some like that. Now, Towhead White was a big time hood. And then Kirksey Nix is still in prison. He's in prison for life. But he actually worked with a guy named Mike Gillick Jr. He was a big time hood. Now, see, all of this ties into the murder of Judge Vincent Sherry and his wife, Margaret, in Biloxi, Mississippi in the 1980s. So they actually hired a hit out on a judge and his wife, and because of a scam that they were running, and the judge got in the middle of it. And so there's a big, huge story there. If anybody wants to look up that story, they can get more idea of who Kirksey Nix and Mike Gillick were. But it's Judge Vincent Sherry. He was murdered in Biloxi, Mississippi. So there's some more. Now, there was one guy that was really psychotic killer. His name was William Mansker Club. They called him Billy Club. And he was known to kill quite a few people. He would definitely be what I would call a serial killer, because it wasn't just a, I'm going to rob you and the robbery goes wrong and I shoot you. It was, he hunted people. He was a violent predator that just literally thrived off of the killing of human beings, it seemed. And so he was really psychotic. And then there's one that there's a book written about him recently, Billy Burt, B-I-R-T, Billy Sunday Burt. He was a big Dixie Mafia killer. So there's quite a few names that we could go over. That, you know, then there were some women. There were some vixens that really run moonshine and prostitution in the South. One lady's name was Cleo Epps. They called her the Queen of the Bootleggers. Around the State Line Mob, one of the female hoodlums up there was named Louise Hathcock. A pistol. She had a restaurant. She had an apron on. She would carry her little receipt book, her pencil, a pistol, and a ball peen hammer. And she was known to beat people with a ball peen hammer. You know, so there were some vixens in the South as well that really. That weren't just mob molds. They were the mob, and the guys followed them. You know,
wow.
That. Yeah.
The book, again, folks, is called Silenced by the Dixie Mafia, The Anderson Files. And Sonova, yes. Cantrell, our guest today, we've talked about kind of an introduction to the Dixie Mafia, some of the big players and names. But again, that, and you touch on those aspects in this book, but this mm-hmm. book is really the story of a big sister. And someone who fought for answers for over five decades, right? Mm-hmm. So why don't you introduce yes. us to this woman and her story?
Okay. Like I said, I work as a victim's advocate with my blog, telling these stories that are not necessarily in mainstream media. I mean, we all know the JonBenet Ramsey case. You know, everyone would like to see it solved, but the constant reporting on JonBenet Ramsey isn't helping. But then you've got all of these people on the fringes that are just begging for that kind of publicity for their case, and they're not getting it. So I really try to focus on them. Well, by doing that, I ran into Phyllis Cook, and she actually, she is the big sister of Ronnie Anderson. Now, Ronnie was a 17-year-old polio victim. He had leg braces, one leg smaller than the other. He was very tenderhearted and very innocent, childlike, even though he was already 17. He was very, I would say he was very naive and very emotionally, he was a little behind. You know, he wasn't mentally underdeveloped, but emotionally he was. And he never could fit in. And, you know, he had these big clunky metal braces that he had to even stand up or sit down, much less walk. And so, but anyway, she kind of took care of him. But her father had gotten into the Dixie Mafia. He was actually one of those, he was kind of a manipulated cop. And so he ended up becoming corrupt through blackmail, basically. He had a gambling addiction, and he was kind of a weak emotional person. Emotionally, he was weak, and so he was easily to blackmail and to pressure. Well, anybody that knows this story, I apologize because I can't go into all of it, but there was a very infamous sheriff that was trying to take down the state line mob, which would eventually kind of morph into the Dixie Mafia. His name was Sheriff Buford Pusser. And he had waged war on Towhead White and the state line for so long, and he ended up getting a hit put out on him. Well, his wife was named Pauline Pusser, and there's a big, you know, three Hollywood movies called Walking Tall that were all about Buford Pusser and the ambush that killed his wife and blew half his face off. Well, what people don't realize, that case was never solved. And this story that I wrote about actually ties into that ambush. What people don't realize is when Buford Pusser walked into that hospital, when he was rolled into the hospital, I should say, his first recollection when they were trying to talk to him before he got his face sewed up and got through surgery and everything, he said there were two cars. Well, after he goes through all these surgeries and all these things, he said, no, I think there's just one car. Well, the problem was that there was two cars. They looked almost the same. One was black. One was a real extremely dark green. So in certain lights, and of course in the dark, it would look black. Well, what happened was this little boy is actually from Mississippi with his dad. Well, there's a hit gone out for the Pussers. And Kirksey Nix is good friends with Towhead White. Kirksey Nix gets a crew not out of Tennessee. He gets his crew out of Mississippi. Kirksey Nix gets several boys to come with him, and they need a getaway car. So they con this little boy into borrowing his dad's car, okay? And they make him think that he's going to get to go for a ride with the guys, and he's going to just really, you know, he's finally going to be accepted. Well, in reality, they were going to use him as a pawn. See, several months, maybe a year or so before this, in a gun battle, Buford Pusser had killed Louise Hathcock, which was Towhead White's girlfriend. Okay. Well, Towhead wanted to hurt Buford the way that he had been hurt. So everyone thought that Buford was the one that had the hit on his head. In reality, Pauline was the one that had the hit on her head. They wanted to kill Pauline. They didn't want to kill Buford. Okay. The plan was to send this little crippled boy up to knock on the door after Buford had been called away on the fake call. Pauline would answer the door because she was seeing this little crippled kid. She wouldn't be intimidated to open the door. The other guys were going to rush in and kill her in her front door, right there in the doorway. Of course, that's not what happened. Pauline rode along with him on that fake call. So that changed the whole plan. So now they ended up having to chase him down. And that's where the regular story picks up. Everyone knows they were ambushed, and that's how the story goes. Well, what happened is 6 weeks to the day after that ambush, they killed Ronnie. Because Ronnie didn't want to go, Ronnie knew what happened, and Ronnie was getting ready to go out of state and live with his sister for a while. And they knew that they couldn't trust him to keep their secret. So not only did they kill Ronnie, they staged a suicide to make it look like he killed himself. But anybody that knew him and knew how his legs worked, knew that there was no way he could prop a gun between his 2 feet and shoot himself that way. But no one would investigate. And that is the start of this whole story with Silence by the Dixie Mafia. Phyllis has fought for over 50 years to get someone to examine her brother's case. And then years later, because of all the stuff, her father ends up being killed as well. And so that's what this book is about. I touch on Buford Pusser. I touch on Towhead White. I touch on Kirksey Nix. I touch on all of the different main characters of the Dixie Mafia. But her story is so integrated with every one of those characters that I couldn't tell her brother's story without touching on all those bases. So this is a really a story about that little boy who was
It is a twisted web, really, that connects to all of these mafia underworld, Dixie Mafia underworld characters.
Yes, it is.
Crazy.
It is. Her father was actually connected because of his gambling addiction. He was very easily manipulated. Excuse me one moment. Sorry.
Now, in looking into this woman's story and trying to get the justice that she seeks, what can you tell us about this case and how it unraveled?
Well, her story is very unique in the fact that there are two staged suicides that have so many obvious holes that anybody in their right mind would question it. The only problem is she has fought for 54 years. Everybody classes her as a grieving family member that won't accept the truth. In reality, her brother could not have killed himself in the way they said. There was no autopsy done, so they can't prove or disprove it because they never did an autopsy. Her father, when he was killed later, they did kind of a botched together looks kind of like it was just thrown together at the last minute type autopsy as well. He has all of these things just don't make sense. There are so many holes in it. Anybody that has watched any true crime shows whatsoever would have enough sense to say this needs to be looked into again. And that's all she's asking. You know, she says, all I want is someone to look at my dad's case, my brother's case, and do something. Well, we've had so much information come in since. See, I ran the blog series about 2.5 years ago. It took 5 weeks worth of blogs to cover each little bit and just highlight the case. Well, I push it out there as far as I can just to get as many eyes on it as possible. Well, after I did that, a investigator came up and she said that she would try to help the list. Well, between that, they started reading my blog and people started coming forward. They didn't realize everything was connected. Someone knew about this little crippled boy that they were using as a pawn. You know, they're like, oh, I know all about the crippled boy. They didn't call him Ronnie. And then they tie everything. They come forward and they're like, oh, I always heard about the crippled boy. My cousin said that they used him because they were wanting to kill Pauline. You know, so we have all these people coming forward with more information after I run the blog series. And so the investigator wrote her book and it was kind of encompassing a whole bunch of different Dixie Mafia characters. And Phyllis's story was just kind of thrown in with it. And it's a good book. It's called The Deadline Confessions. I think that's what it's called. And it's by T.A. Powell, if anyone wants to check that out. And it's a good book. It's just, it doesn't focus solely on Phyllis's story. It's got a bunch of stories together. Well, after that, we've had all sorts of people come in and verify different points and things. But we now believe not only did Ronnie's dad's car, his name was Dan, not only was Dan's car used in the ambush of Buford Pusser, his son was there, even though he didn't want to be. And we also believe now that some information's come in, they never did find the ambush weapons. We also believe that Dan Anderson had them hidden behind his bedroom door for like 10, 15 years.
No kidding.
After they were noticed and someone questioned, they disappeared. And so my Phyllis believes that what happened was his son was manipulated into borrowing the car. He comes home. Dan finds out what happened. He tells his son to keep his mouth shut. Don't say a word. Within days, that car is gone. We believe it's the one that they ended up blowing up in front of the courthouse in Oklahoma within a few months later. But within days, Dan doesn't own that car anymore. But then also, we believe that he kept those guns as a security measure because he was afraid that he had to have some kind of ace in the hole type thing. And so his daughter, it was over a decade later, was helping him clean his house after his second wife died. And she was cleaning his bedroom, and she found these guns hidden in behind the door for the bedroom door. So you had to open the door and then move something to see them. Well, she was just vacuuming and everything, and she laid it across the bed. And when her dad came in, he threw a fit, and she almost went psychotic, and she didn't understand why. And so he's like, don't you ever touch that again. And she didn't understand why. Well, years later, when these witnesses start coming forward, they believe that Dan sat on those guns for a while. Now, they're not there now, obviously, but after he was killed, they believe that they spent several days in that house looking for any proof that Dan had against them. Because, see, Dan wasn't really necessarily a hardcore criminal. He was a very, he was bipolar, and I don't know, he had all kinds of problems and had to take medicine and stuff. And he was always kind of had this inferiority complex where he was trying to be something, you know, almost the same thing his son had, but he didn't have the physical handicap that his son had. And so, but he was extremely addicted to gambling, and they used that against him. And so Phyllis really believes that he was just trying to keep some kind of control over the situation, to where if something came up, he'd have something to combat it with. And but that's where this is. And that's what this story entails. It tells all of the stuff that happened. It tells how the information has come out since the investigator helped. It tells all about this. And then at the end of the book, there's a plea for help. I just put it out there. I only have a pen. I can write, and I'm pretty good at marketing, so I try to use what I have to help these victims' families. But I don't have a badge, I'm not an attorney. I'm not a DA. I can't do anything else. This is all I have. I've made the blog. I've pushed them out. I've made the book. I'm marketing it out. I've made the YouTube videos. I've pushed them out, but I can't close the case for this little boy.
Right.
And the book ends. It ends with a plea for somebody that has the ability to step up.
So is it that the Dixie Mafia's tendrils are still so entwined? Is that what's muting the court systems? Or is it that to them, they look at this story as so old, it doesn't matter. Let's just move on. What do you think is going on there for real?
Well, honestly, at the time, there is definite proof that the police department in that area was corrupt. And I can say that without any fear because it is legitimate. Everyone knows it. Leroy Hobbs was arrested and put in jail and he was the head of it, and so it's come to light that there was a lot of corruption in the police department at that time. Now, nowadays, I don't know that there's necessarily corruption, but I'm also wondering if they're hesitant to open old wounds, because there was so much corruption to begin with.
I see. Yeah, it gets into the situation of what do you do? How do you protect the past and the present by admitting corruption? Then you have to kind of answer to, well, what else has been hidden? What else has happened?
Right.
Right. Oh, jeez.
And so I really think it's a little bit of both. But then Phyllis, and she will tell you, she's like, I've made a pest of myself. I call all the time, you know. So she, but you can't really blame her either. I mean, she watched her 17-year-old brother be brutally murdered. She watched her father be brutally murdered, and nobody's doing anything. I think I would be more than a pest, you know. And so she's like, I've called and I've called and I've called, you know. And so they kind of label her as well. They've even said it in the FOIA request that they put together, that she's just a grieving family member that can't accept the truth. And what's scary is this is a legitimate case that has massive glaring holes in it. And if it was my case, I would be begging for someone to help me too, you know? It's just sad that in our modern day and age that cases like this can go cold. And I'm just asking, why don't people care? You know, if it was your crippled little brother who never had a chance in life anyways, and then this happens to them, wouldn't you go to heck and back trying to get justice for him? I mean, I know, sure. I would.
Right.
You know, and so I tried to really tailor this book to him, because the other book that was written has a lot of the legal stuff in it. It's got a lot of the other cases that don't have anything to do with Ronnie, you know, and it's like a big 400-page book. So, I mean, it's got a lot of content in it. I highly recommend it. But I wanted to, and I told her, I said, because I'm one of the few crime writers, I don't write for the gore and I don't write for the shock value. I come at it from a victim's standpoint because I'm a victim's advocate. So my crime writing is a little different than a lot of people's. And so this is a story to honor that little boy, you know? And so that's the reason why I kept it, you know, to less than 200 pages. I kept it here, and there's a lot of family photographs that Phyllis gave me permission to use in the book. You look at this little boy, and I don't know how much research you got to do beforehand, but you look at this picture of Ronnie Anderson. Of course, it's black and white, but he's a dead ringer for Ashton Kutcher. I've got a picture of him and Ashton Kutcher spliced together, and he's just a beautiful little boy. And it just, to me, maybe I've got too big of a heart, but I couldn't pass it up. I told her, yes, I will write this book for Ronnie. I will put it out there. And if I can make it a New York Times bestseller, somebody somewhere's got to get up and do something. And so that's what my purpose is.
When is the most recent piece of information that's come in?
I will be honest with you. We get tidbits even to this day. Phyllis will get tidbits of information sent to her within weeks ago. I mean, she will get some little tidbit of information because people are finally starting to come forward and talk. And so the last bit of information that I got, she ended up getting, see, her father's Cadillac was one of his big things. He loved his car. Well, that disappeared within days after the ambush on Buford Pusser. And so she wanted to know what happened, and he just left her off. Well, she's got now research. She's got definite proof of where that Cadillac went after it left her father. You know, she's got little records of what happened to his Cadillac. He had another Cadillac that disappeared after he died. It was in the driveway on the day of his death. But then when she got there to, you know, the next morning, it was gone. And so, she never did get it. She never could get it back. Well, she's got proof of where that went after his death, you know? So there's little tidbits like that, that keep coming through. And that deal with the car came through just about a month or so ago.
Now, is the person that the car went to a suspect? Is it just maybe that they were in financial straits and had to sell the car? What do you think we've uncovered from that information?
Well, see, the Cadillac was sitting in the driveway where he supposedly committed suicide. Okay, the one supposed witness to this actually said it was there. Okay, in the police report, it was there. Well, time Phillips gets there, because see, by now she's living in Georgia, so it takes a few hours for her to get there. They don't call her. This supposedly happened at 4 o'clock or so in the afternoon. They don't call her till after midnight. So it's the next morning before she gets there. And by then, there is no crime scene whatsoever. It looks like they hired professional housekeepers to come in there and detail the house. Not a speck of dust on anything, nothing. Nowhere. She said it looked like someone had detailed that house. His car was gone. And then she starts looking around. All of his Masonic jewelry, all of his antiques, all of his crystal, all of everything was gone. There was just a few scattered pieces left on the shelves, and they were spaced out to where you wouldn't just look at it and notice a gap. And she started looking around, and everything was gone. Everything of any value in that house was gone. And she asked about it, and they just kept saying, making up excuses. And they said, well, they tried to say he was going to jail for bad checks. They tried to say that he racked up a bunch of gambling debt. Well, she knows that's not true, because she took care of his finances because of his gambling problem. So she knew what went in and went out. And then she went and verified, with the judge, no, your dad wasn't getting into trouble for anything. And so it's just one big conglomerated mess. And every time I talk about the Dixie Mafia, you hear that term grassroots network. And I'm like, that's exactly how you label the Dixie Mafia. You know, if you go out in your yard and you try to pull up one blade of grass by the root, you can't. You can pull up a handful, and it's all connected to everything else. And that's the way these stories are. They're all so interconnected that you can't just pick out one story and talk about it.
Fascinating, dark, twisted. It's heartbreaking to hear this. And I understand, victim advocacy. Certainly Tim and I are big for that. We want people to feel that, justice will be served for the loss of their loved ones, that they aren't forgotten, and that their loved ones aren't forgotten. But I've got to say, it's when you look at a case this far out, can we even trust information that comes forward at this point?
Yes and no. And this is what I tell them, and this is what I told Phyllis when I started researching things. I said, I read everything there is, and then I have to weed out the garbage and just take the facts that I can verify. So anything I can bring in and verify it with two or three other independent sources, I keep. But then there's some things that I will say right up in the book that this is just a rumor from the rumor mill, or this is an unverified idea, because there isn't a lot that you can do. And like Phyllis said, if someone came in, they got this in the court right now, and there are a few people still alive that had to do with this. So there are some people that could take to court.
What would you think it would take that would actually get law enforcement to reopen and reexamine this case? What is that legitimately going to look like?
I really think it needs a massive media push so there's a public outcry, because there's a lot of cases now that are being solved, all these cold cases that are being solved, because different podcasts, different shows, different writers are really pushing it, and they bring enough publicity to it that there's a public outcry, and it forces their hand. They can't ignore it anymore. And in reality, we've got to have a DA that is willing to take on the case, because it doesn't matter how much we shout to the rooftops, that this needs to be done, until we get a DA that's willing to take it to court. Now, it can be taken to court under the RICO Act, because there's all kinds of different things in this case that it's connected to that crossing state lines, there's, you know, all kinds of alcohol, drugs and all kinds of different things that could class it under the RICO Act. So it could legitimately take been taken to court. But
right,
like
but
Phyllis
at this
says,
point,
even
at this point, is there anybody to bring to court to make
yes,
pay for this?
Yes. Yes. There are. There are about four or five people that are in this case that are still alive that could be brought to justice for this. And there are some people that's still alive for it. And it would be nice if they had to pay for their crimes. But even like Phyllis says, after 54 years, it won't really be justice, you know, because they've got to live their life for 54 years. And Ronnie got his taken from him. And so it's one of those things where, what do you do? You're kind of at a bad spot, because there's, I don't know, four or five people that I can think of off the top of my head in this book that could face justice for it. But they're at an age now where a lot of these witnesses are dying off. A lot of the people that we have talked to and have come forward in the last 2 years have died off, you know. And so what do you do when all of your witnesses are gone and you're left with nothing but, you know, circumstantial evidence and hearsay testimony? You know what I'm saying? So I don't know what can be done. You know, after all of this time, I'm not a legal authority. So I don't know. It's such a mess that I don't know. I always try to say that there's always hope. But in this case, it's hard to say that.
Do you think that you will become, how do I put this properly? I don't want to sound like a henny penny. The sky is falling, but by digging at the Dixie Mafia, which sounds horrific and terrifying, by digging at them, are you afraid that's going to put you in danger at some point?
Somewhat. I mean, you always have to be cautious when you write about these things. But a lot of them are gone, and most of everything that I write has already been public knowledge. It might be something that's forgotten, but it's all been reported before. Now, some of the things that have come up new with Phyllis's case are new, but I'm not the only one shouting to the rooftops. There's other authors, there's other writers, there's other, you know, bloggers and podcasters. And so it's not just me. So I'm not the, you know, the lone wolf out there, you know, causing trouble. But yeah, I mean, you always have to take precautions and you always have to be careful with what you say and do. And there's always a risk factor when you do this kind of thing. But you have to, you know, what do? You can't turn a blind eye, or you're not a whole lot better than those that turned a blind eye before, you know.
Crazy stuff. The book, again, we have a link for it in today's program, Silenced by the Dixie Mafia, The Anderson Files, Sonova Cantrell. Sonova, we've got links up for your different social media and for the book. Thank you so much for stopping by and enlightening on this. We're not familiar with this story. We're not familiar with this aspect. And now you've opened the eyes to many of our listeners to this. So thank you so much for doing that.
Yes, thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure speaking with you. Interesting stuff, folks. And again, I know we have listeners all over the world. If you know anything about this case, email me, dave@darknessradio.com. I'll pass it on to Sonova and the authorities and see if maybe we can get the true answers for this story and a deeper understanding. Sonova, stay safe, and thank you again for visiting with us here on True Crime Tuesday.
Thank you. You have a good one.
All right, folks, the case files are rattling. We've got some of the most unusual stories right now in Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, it's time now to look into these case files, Tim. Put your, reach right over there. Right, yeah, right there. And grab that clothespin, Tim.
Okay.
You're going to need that for the second part of today's stories.
Okay.
Uh-huh. That's all I can say, all Tim. Right. I'm giving you a little forewarning. Listeners, be prepared. Don't be eating a meal during, well, actually any of this segment, because there's some gross topics coming up here. First story, Tim. Slovenian woman does something a little drastic in order for an insurance payout. We're going to go to Ljubljana, Slovenia, Tim.
Oh,
Ljubljana.
Yes.
I don't know how else you'd say. Ljubljana. Ljubljana, Slovenia.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're going to a court in Slovenia where on Friday they sentenced a 22-year-old woman to 2 years in prison for deliberately cutting off her own hand with a circular saw in order to make a fraudulent insurance claim. The district court in Ljubljana said Julia Adzlisic agreed with her boyfriend to have her left hand severed above the wrist in their home in the capital early in 2019. She was just found guilty of attempted insurance fraud. About a year earlier, she signed contracts with five different insurance companies, the court said. The woman stood to collect more than 1 million euro. About half paid immediately, the rest in regular monthly installments. Her boyfriend was sentenced to 3 years in prison, while his father received a 1-year suspended sentence. The pair had taken her to the hospital, saying she had injured herself while sawing branches. Authorities said they left the severed hand behind rather than bringing it to the hospital to ensure the disability would be permanent. But police recovered, and it was reattached.
Ugh.
Yeah. Prosecutors said that days before the incident, Aldizic's partner searched for information on the internet about how artificial hands work. They claim that this was another piece of proof that it was done deliberately. During the trial, the woman claimed innocence, saying she would never have cut her hand off deliberately. No one wants to be crippled, she told the court. My youth has been destroyed. I lost hand at the age of 20. Only I know how it happened.
To moose and squirrel, evidently.
Yeah, the trial has attracted lots of public and media attention in the small Alpine state. We believe the sentences are fair and appropriate and will serve their purpose, said Judge Margita Dvornik. I think just losing your hand is enough. Now you got to go to jail? But she took it seriously when her boyfriend asked her to give him a hand.
God.
All right, that's enough. Tim, our next story in the body parts department. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
A Kentucky man was arrested after taking a 5-hour bus ride to visit his parents in Illinois. Well, that doesn't sound like a crime. What if the suitcases he carried, though, were stuffed with body parts of a woman believed to be his girlfriend, Tim? Do you think that would be enough to turn this into a crime?
Yeah.
Well, Melvin Martin Jr. recently hopped on a Greyhound bus in Louisville, Kentucky, Tim.
Oh, not Louisville.
Louisville, Kentucky. With the luggage and headed to downtown Chicago, the Chicago Sun-Times reported. Martin Jr.'s parents then took him, and unwittingly, the bags concealed the dismembered body to their home in Markham. That's even more crazy. Traveling body parts, David Scott, who lives across the street, told CBS Chicago. You only see stuff like this on TV. Now, the kin soon grew suspicious because Martin Jr. never unpacked the heavy bags after several days and kept guarding them. There were some early reports of a foul odor coming from the bags, Markham Police Chief Terry White told the network. The family made the grisly discovery on Monday morning when Martin Jr. went out to the library. The human body part was discovered, said White. They immediately backed away and called police. White said the body's parts appeared to be those of Martin Jr.'s 31-year-old girlfriend, according to the Sun-Times. The couple lived together in Kentucky, where other body parts were found, according to White. With the remains we have here, we have the advantage of dental records. And then, of course, there is DNA, White said. Of course, her upper torso remains in Kentucky. So the levels of the forensic, I'm sure, mirror ours. So I'm quite sure that there's going to be a positive identification about this victim. Authorities from the FBI, Markham and Louisville, were investigating this case. Martin Jr. was charged with a felony count of being a fugitive from justice. Additional charges, of course, are pending, police officers have said. I wonder what the claim is for transporting desecrated body parts. I mean, there's got to be something for everything, right?
Yeah.
Oh, good God. Horrifying. In another body part story, but a little less offensive, Tim, because I'm going to stop it down before we get into the reach over and grab your clothespin section of today's Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals.
All right.
Apparently, this guy, a big fan of Marty McFly, Tim.
Okay.
An Alaskan dentist extracted a patient's tooth while riding on a hoverboard.
What?
Yeah, he's been sentenced to 12 years behind bars for that stunt and other wheelie bad crimes, according to the article. Yes, Tim.
No.
Wheelie bad crimes. Seth Lookhart was sentenced Monday in Anchorage Superior Court on dozens of charges that stemmed from actions that ranged from his scooting antics to Medicaid fraud and removing a patient's tooth without their permission. That's what the Anchorage Daily News reported. He was convicted back in January on charges of reckless endangerment, illegally practicing dentistry, and medical assistance fraud. In reviewing all of this over and over again, I have this visceral response. You darn near killed some people. That's what Judge Michael Wolverton said in handing down the sentence. The court heard testimony at his trial from patient Veronica Wilhelm, who was sedated when he was recorded performing her tooth extraction whilst riding a hoverboard in July of 2016. In the cell phone video, Lookhart could be seen riding away from the procedure with his hands triumphantly in the air. He allegedly texted a video of the stunt to at least 8 people, joking that it was a new standard of care, NBC News reported. Lookhart, whose dental license was suspended in 2017, was also ordered by the judge not to practice medicine during his 10-year probation once he released from prison, the Anchorage Daily News reported. Just 10 years, though. That's all, Tim. Just wait 10 years before you can go back to hoverboard dental extraction.
I didn't know that there's a huge audience for that deal. It's not something you normally see in the X Games.
No.
But hey, maybe it's coming to an X Games near you. Who knows?
I'm curious, though. I got to be honest. I'm curious. What is the crime of just standing on a hoverboard and extracting a tooth?
You ever been on a hoverboard?
I have not, because I have trouble on my own feet, let alone standing on something I'm supposed to balance on.
That would explain what the big crime would be, because those things are so teetery that you just one slip and boom, you've just damaged a patient.
Extracting the tooth, though, as I recall, youngster, tying string around my tooth to a doorknob, slamming said doorknob in order to yank tooth out. Wouldn't that only help if you're on the hoverboard, clamping on a tooth and you slip off? Bink!
When was the last time you were at a dentist?
I don't like the dentist, Tim. They unnerve me.
That's why
you should always keep us a healthy 5 to 6 feet away from me, even if COVID isn't taking place.
It's an exact science. There's no string and doorknob when you go to the dentist, Dave. There's tools. They actually...
I don't like those. The scrapey bits? Oh, God.
It's more than just like a knife and a hammer, and they don't go in with archaic tools now. They actually, dentistry is actually a doctorate. They actually do things now to try and save your teeth. I don't know if you know that or not.
Oh, gross.
Yeah.
So weird. I've only had one cavity in my entire life, and I don't really believe it was a cavity.
What do you believe it was? A donut?
I think the dentist was a dick when I was a young boy.
Uh-huh.
And because I remember he had that little hooked instrument, he put it on there, and I remember him working it back and forth on the spot.
Uh-huh.
And then telling my dad, "Oh, he's got a cavity." And I was like, my tooth didn't hurt until he put a hook in it and worked it for a while. Because it wasn't like he was scraping away things like they do, which is so horrible. Ugh, I hate it. He like put the hook in there and dug at that spot repeatedly for quite a while, creating said. Because honestly, here's why I stand by that. I am 52 years old, Tim.
Okay.
And I do go to the dentist. once every 5 or 6 years. Anyway, I go and I have had no cavities since I was 10 years old. So I felt them digging and digging and digging. I don't think I'd have ever had a cavity. Hmm. My teeth are the only strong part of my body. I got a bad heart, bad esophagus, bad stomach, bad bowels. I've got bad knees, Tim. I've got a bad shoulder. I get migraines, bad eyes. You know, my teeth are my only prime example.
Hmm.
And, well, I do have that and the ability to create children simply by staring at a woman too long.
Oh, good for you.
So that's, that virility is strong, too. So my teeth and the ability to inseminate, those are my strengths.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Congratulations.
I got nothing more than that.
Yeah.
First, I mean, my amazing family and wife and children, those are strengths, but they're not something I created. Mm. My teeth and the ability to procreate is something that I'm in charge of.
So why did your dad not turn around and sue the dentist then, if you believe that?
You know, I didn't talk about it till I was older, and I was like, you know, I never have cavities. But I recall, because I hated how he just kept digging and digging and digging. You know, he just comes in, he tells my dad, yeah, he's got a cavity, we got to fill it. My dad's like, all right, go ahead, fill it. That was it.
Hmm.
But then, and that, you know what, I will tell you, there was another dentist that I visited when I first moved to Minnesota in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
88, I went to college. 90, I consider myself becoming an inhabitant of the great state of Minnesota. But I went in, and the guy's like, oh, you've got eight, you know, cavities. We got I'm like, eight? That can't be right. And then I avoided the dentist for about 2 years. Then I went to another dentist, and he did a new set of x-rays.
Okay.
And he said, hey, you have two cavities. And I'm like, well, they seem to be healing themselves. So I waited another 2 years and went back to the dentist. No cavities. So my teeth are somehow miraculously filling in their own cavities, or these suckers are lying and just trying to get some extra work out of my insurance companies. I'm just saying.
Hmm.
I'm just saying. And then ever since I've gone, I've had a couple of hit spots. They're like, yeah, you're going to want to keep an eye on that. Brush better. Do this and you'll be good to go, which I've done, and I never end up with cavities. But, you know, to go from, oh, you've got like eight to two to none.
But here's the failure in that statement is you don't regenerate enamel.
Well, obviously, that's my point, that they were lying then. I was either regenerating tooth enamel, or the dentists were trying to get my insurance company to pay out for you know, fees that I didn't need.
Well, it would be the latter, because you don't regenerate enamel.
You know, that was a bit, my bit of sarcasm to that aspect of the story, but weird. All right. So we're going to one to cleanse the palate here, Tim, before we go into the depravity of the next or last three stories. We have one just to clear the palate of body parts.
Okay.
Into this, Tim. And this is our weekly case of swift justice, swift justice, swift justice. Sometimes it doesn't pay to pull a fast one, Tim. That's what she said. A man left behind a winning lottery ticket in Georgia when he fled during a traffic stop on Interstate 75, according to the Cherokee County Sheriff's Office. To the suspect, who ran on foot from our deputies at a traffic stop this morning on I-75, you left behind your $100 lottery ticket in your vehicle, the agency wrote on Monday. They added the scratch-off ticket was waiting for him when he wants to swing by the sheriff's office. That's kind of them, Tim. They're just holding it. They pulled it out because they knew it could get looted from the car. They took the winning, and they're just saying, hey, if you ran off, you left this behind, come on in and get it. What? That is taking law enforcement one step further, Tim. The Brotherhood of Blue, they're trying to watch out for this guy's belongings, mm-hmm. even though he's a criminal. That, to me, is great. Come on in. We'll just give it to you. We've got it sitting here. You deserve it. We got it. Let's get this thing done.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yes, he will get the lottery ticket back, but we're keeping the methamphetamine, the agency also wrote.
Oh.
Yeah. Seems like a fair trade.
Well, you think they would watch one thing, they would watch the other for him and just give them both back, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, now, this woman didn't want to be one to leave something behind in the car, Tim. Now, this is the part in the show where you reach across, grab your clothespin, put it on your nose, put down your food, do not eat.
Oh, as I just took a drink of something. Okay, go ahead.
Here's a headline that caught my attention and the attention of many of our listeners, because this was this week's most sent news story, Tim.
All right.
Oklahoma woman told officer, "I have to poop so bad," before she led them on a high-speed chase. We're going to Enid, Oklahoma. An Oklahoma woman who refused to cooperate during a traffic stop sparked a high-speed chase and guns being drawn in a neighborhood. 28-year-old Emily Owings was initially pulled over for not wearing her seatbelt. She also didn't have a license or her insurance. The only form of identification she had on her was her medical marijuana card. Both body camera footage shows what happened next. "Your license is suspended," the officer said. "Why?" Owings said. "I don't know," the officer said. "I didn't know that," Owings said. "Now, I am waiting to see if you have any warrants outstanding through Woods County," the officer replied. "But I have to poop so bad," Owings said. "Where do you think I was going?" the officer asked. "It's my birthday," Owings said. "It's my fucking birthday!" Police then discovered there was a warrant out for her arrest for allegedly fighting an officer. In an alleged cop fight club, I guess.
A cop fight club.
"Why don't you please just let me go?" Owings said. "Because your license is suspended," the officer said. "I'm sorry, I didn't know. Otherwise, I won't drive no more. But can I please go home? I have to poop." The officer then called for backup. Meanwhile, she was not backed up much longer. "If I can get you to step out of the vehicle for me," the officer said. "Are you going to arrest me?" Owings said. "You are, in fact, under arrest," the officer said. "Are you kidding me? I have to poop." "You have warrants in Woods County, and they are coming to get you," the officer said. "No, they're not," Owings said. "F you guys." Owings put the key in the ignition and sped off.
Whoa.
Pursuit lasted several blocks, with speeds topping 70 miles an hour. That's pretty regular driving to me, but whatever. Whoa. Police say Owings blew through stop signs and a school zone. She eventually stopped, surrendered when police officers pointed guns at her. Owings could not let the subject drop as she was cuffed and taken to a squad car. "Can I poop in your car, man?" Owings said. "You could have already been on your way to jail," the officer said. "Yeah," Owings said, "but not pooping." Police searched Owings' car and found a pipe with meth inside it. Owings was then booked into the Garfield County Detention Center and faces several felony charges. She was able to eventually poop while in custody, Tim.
All right, so she got to rip one off.
Uh-huh. Here's part two. It's when it rains, it poop pours, Tim.
Oh, no.
Because we get not one poop story, but two. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
They're calling this a shit and run, Tim.
Oh, no.
I'm just reading the article as written.
Oh, no.
Cops in Ontario, Canada are investigating the bizarre case of a man or woman who broke into a house and pooped in the dishwasher.
What?
The unnamed trespasser entered the home through a sliding glass door between 1 and 8:15 a.m. Sunday while residents were asleep, according to a report filed Monday by the Guelph Police Service. The poopy perp didn't actually steal anything, but instead defecated on the open door before leaving the residence, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation reports. Anybody with the scoop on the poop and information on the turd burglar, Tim, is urged to contact Constable John Hunt at 519-824-1212, extension 7359, or Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-8477, per the release. Both releases, actually, Tim. The release of the bowels and the release of this PR notice. The Guelph Police also reminded the public to properly secure your residence by always locking all your doors and windows. There's been an uptick in public pooping incidents in recent years, which doctors attribute to a bizarre disorder where the culprit experiences sexual gratification from defecating.
No, really?
In a daylight.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a thing. But again, if you know who the mad pooper of Ontario is pooping in dishwashers, call Constable John Hunt, 519-824-1212, extension 7359. Tell him you heard about the case here on Darkness Radio's True Crime Tuesday, and you know the answer. But only if you legitimately know who this Canadian pooper is.
The Canadian pooper. I believe he's on WWE now.
Actually, that should be the Canadian crapper.
Canadian crapper, yes. Yeah. Actually, that's a great drink if you ever order it at the bar.
The Canadian crapper. The Canadian great
crapper.
Drink.
It is. It's made with whiskey.
See that on an upcoming episode of On the Rocks with Mally Fox. Can you two whip up a Canadian crapper?
It actually is the featured drink next month. It's a whiskey drink, Dave. It's a whiskey drink. Okay, here's the deal. These crimes are so solvable, Dave. And here's the deal. I'm sure a police department, and back me up if there's any police officers that are out there listening, I'm sure they will, with one email, back me up on this. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
This is how it's easily solvable, Dave. But police officers will say it's too expensive. And it has to do with a DNA test. You can test the DNA of said crap.
I know that.
Yeah.
Here's what I believe it was one of the kids in the house, probably sleepwalking.
That could be.
Pooped,
yeah.
Pooped in it.
Yeah,
I watch a friend of mine when I was a kid. He would get up and poop or pee in weird places. So I never had sleepovers or allowed him to sleep over at my house.
Mm-hmm.
I would occasionally sleep at his house where sometimes he would get up and pee into the closet. He once went over, opened a drawer and pooped into the drawer. Mm-hmm. He should be thankful that video phones were not a thing back then, because I would have been streaming that stuff like mad.
My on a family trip, my youngest sister, Stephanie, got up and peed in my sister Colleen's suitcase.
Nice.
She was sleepwalking and she
Excellent.
Just got up and peed in the suitcase. It does happen. And I think you're right. I think it probably was just somebody in the household didn't realize that they soiled the dishwasher on their own,
did and then didn't want to admit to it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's easily solvable with a DNA test, but the police will tell you that it's too expensive to do that.
Well, yeah, because you don't want to, you don't want to just do that all the time, especially on poop. Well, Tim, we're at the part of the show which I'm calling the trifecalta.
No,
instead of trifecta.
Yeah.
This is equal to Tim, our third and final story.
Okay.
It's just to Maine. We've all seen some pretty crappy political campaigns, Tim.
Oh, no.
Police in Maine are hunting a middle-aged woman down who has been dumping poop in Trump supporters' mailboxes, according to a report on Thursday.
Oh, no.
She has been picking up feces and putting it in mailboxes, specifically of those who have Trump signs outside.
Oh,
Alicia Cantwell, a patrol officer with Hamden Public Safety, told WGME the Doggy Doo Deliverer was spotted both Sunday, the Canadian Crapper and the Doggy Doo Deliverer, Tim. That was wasn't that a failed movie with Robert Redford and Paul Newman?
Yep, yeah. It was third time they tried to get together and make a movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
Didn't work so well. The Doggy Doo Deliverer was spotted both Sunday and Monday. Because a good crap deliverer does not take a day off, Tim.
Nope.
Snapped riding a purple bike around Hampton while wearing a matching colored T-shirt, glasses, and Crocs.
Oh, of course.
This person is all in purple. All in purple. Purple Crocs, purple T-shirt, riding a purple bike.
So they think you're looking at Barney the dinosaur?
Uh-huh. She's also been defacing Trump signs, writing comments on the signs. Canwell told the police station without elaborating. The mystery cyclist potentially faces charges for defacing political advertising and vandalism. I'm so over all this crap, one local Shelley Grant Beale replied in the police wanted photo. Do not approach this lady. She is armed and dangerous. She joked, using an emoji for poop, Tim.
You know,
so this is not a political statement, folks. It is just a dumb crime and a stupid criminal. Just happen to have the word Trump in the story. So don't come blasting us either way. We're not advocating for or against said pooping, drive-by pooping. But that's this week's dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
Wait,
if you have cases,
something.
Hold on. If you have cases in your area and you're new to the show, even if you're old to the show, if you have dumb crimes, stupid criminals, email those stories to us. We'll talk about them on an upcoming episode. If you yourself have had a dumb crime in your own past and you'd like to share those stories, you can email us your story. It doesn't have to have appeared in the news. You could just email us, dave@darknessradio.com. Tell us your dumb crime, and we will talk about that on a future episode. We can do it anonymously and only refer to you as like Timmy D or Davey S or Winnie J, just something that will give a name, not exactly who you are. But you can email me your own dumb crime. Or if you want to shout it from the mountaintops because you're proud of it, you can email it to us and give us your full name and we'll use it on air. dave@darknessradio.com is the way to reach out to me for those stories. Yes, Tim, what did you want to share?
Well, it was about that past story, but we're past it now.
Well, go ahead. No, I just wanted to make sure I remind people how to email us.
It's that people don't realize in this heated political climate that it is a crime to deface any political advertisement, even though that political candidates, it doesn't matter if it's a local race, state race, national race, even though that they're putting these signs out in good faith on people's lawns and people are endorsing these signs that are on their lawns. You have to remember, even though people put these signs out in good faith on their lawns, you do not have the right to deface any political advertising whatsoever that's put out on people's lawns. Just remember that it is a crime if you do that.
See, that is a public service announcement from your very own Darkness Radio, Timmy D. There is one other crime I'd like to talk about that was perpetrated on the great state of Minnesota, Tim, this last offseason.
Okay.
A 3-year contract extension for the Minnesota Vikings head coach, Mike Zimmer. After the first two games of the season, I'm crying for justice, Tim.
You know, it just wasn't a crime there. They extended the contract as well of the general manager who should have gotten the HEVO as well.
And our middling quarterback.
Yeah, he got an extension as well, who should have been he should have been put on the scrap heap too.
Nice. Oh, these are true crimes against humanity. Yeah. Well, that's it for this week. We will be back next Tuesday with more of the best in true crime talk radio. And you can join us every week for the best in paranormal talk radio with Darkness Radio. And here's the exciting news, folks. You can get brand new episodes commercial free just by being a follower here on Stitcher Premium. For those of you that don't want to pay for the episodes of Darkness Radio, you can listen to them on the regular podcast formats, but they will have commercials inserted. The commercial-free versions are available here and only here on Stitcher Premium, as well as our Darkhives. That's right, the Darkhives of our show that we'll be making available, that will be spanning a 14-year span of our history on this program. You'll be able to hear them. Tim will be adding them up slowly onto podcast formats here through Stitcher Premium and their other delivery sources. So check that out as well. That's it for this week. Stay safe. Stay calm. We'll see you again right here on the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday.